Yeah, this presentation is essentially road testing the framing for a book I'm currently trying to write, which sort of attempts to synthesize about 12 years of research that I've done on the politics of land, the politics of agriculture, social policy, and employment in Ethiopia, some of which as part of this Effective States and Inclusive Development Research Centre, which is based in Manchester, and some of it sort of going back to my PhD research some time ago. And so it kind of tries to bring together a whole range of different key informant interviews with senior politicians, technocrats, donors, but then also a series of case studies on agricultural investments, policy implementation, smallholder agriculture and land access and so on. So the result of that may be that it seems as though I'm trying to cram in rather a lot into quite a short presentation, for which I apologise. I will at points skate over some rather big debates quite quickly, so feel free to pull me up on that later on, and I'm happy to discuss more. In terms of what I'm doing now, first of all, I'll try and lay out the basic rationale of the study and some of the key arguments that I'll put forward, the analytical framework that I use to analyse the politics of distribution, or at least the core components of it. And then the actual empirical analysis is going to be split into two main parts. First of all, looking at sort of the early era of what the TPLF and EPRDF have tried to do in Ethiopia in terms of distribution, and then subsequently how they responded to what they themselves termed as Armageddons or existential crises and the emergence of the developmental state agenda. And then finally, reflecting a little bit on more recent events in Ethiopia and what this means beyond that. In terms of the rationale, I mean, it's basically the purpose is to try and reconcile two quite distinct images of Ethiopia currently. So on the one hand, you have the shining success stories of industrial parks, the Addis Light Railway, and the Renaissance Dam. I did say I would mention dams briefly, but I'm not going to dwell on them. Alongside the Oromo protests that have shaken the country in the last few years and the current political turmoil that's going on within the country. More precisely, I mean, the question is essentially why Ethiopia went through a period of relative political stability through the 1990s and early 2000s in the midst of pretty modest economic performance for the most part. And then just as everything's taking off and, you know, you've got all these success stories which increasingly media and academic, receiving a lot of media and academic attention, at that point the politics unravels and the whole thing comes crashing down, or we'll see where it's going. And the argument is essentially that these are not unrelated to each other. So what the paper tries to do is to zoom out from some of the sort of, there's been some really good analysis recently, particularly on the industrial parks, looking at sort of how they're trying to capture part of the global value chains in textiles and apparel and so on. But to zoom out and set those kind of success stories or potentially emerging success stories in a much bigger political, economic, historical context, to try and understand how the EPRDF's distributional strategy has changed and evolved over a longer period of time. And then to sort of link to a kind of the big sort of theoretical question, essentially, that there's been a lot of work on the politics of development, politics of growth in recent years, including by colleagues of mine in Manchester, but also people like Mushtaq Khan, people within developmental state literature and so on, which basically argues that certain forms of politics underpin periods of economic growth, that you need certain forms of centralization of power, coherent ruling elite, a coherent long-term development vision and so on, and certain forms of state capacity. Yet the process of structural transformation and economic growth in themselves transforms class structures, leads to creative destruction and mobilization of new political forces, which then continually challenge that original politics, even if it exists in the first place. It's continually challenged by the mobilization that goes with rapid economic growth. So the question then becomes, how do you actually manage that process in the longer term, rather than just sort of the politics underpinning the initial launch of a growth episode, but how do you actually maintain that and over a longer period entailing structural transformation? what the paper doesn't do, presentation doesn't do, I should probably clarify from the beginning, the scare quotes around developmental state is not an accident. I'm basically trying to sidestep that debate. I'm not going to get into definitional debates, which I'm not sure are terribly useful about whether Ethiopia is or isn't a developmental state. It's kind of used in terms of the narrative of what the Ethiopian government calls its development model, its particular strategy at the moment, rather than trying to get into sort of a definitional debate about whether it fits the sort of East Asian model or so on. I also don't claim to provide anything like a clear, complete explanation for the Oromo protests and the sort of recent political events, which were, you know, are fundamentally complex issues. Although I think that, you know, this distributional story, which I'll talk about, is part of that bit of that underlying process. And also, sadly, I don't give any much of an indication about quite what the new administration is up to currently, or what their evolving agenda is, which I think is speculation from anyone who really comments on it at the moment. The key arguments which I'll put forward is one that, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how the EPRDF has sought to legitimate itself based on double-digit growth in recent years. So there's been a sort of a common narrative within the literature. Essentially, it's the attempt to sort of counterbalance that they've always been essentially fundamentally concerned with distributional outcomes as well as just growth at all costs. Primarily because of the impact that distributional outcomes then have on social and political stability. Second, the way that they've tried to sort of manage this distributional strategy and manage political stability has evolved over time with changing political economy. That initially it was based around this sort of what I would call an agrarian model, where they're essentially trying to secure, guarantee access to land to smallholder farmers as a key mechanism of distribution. But gradually that's worked through demographic changes, but also the developmental state agenda, that's kind of no longer a plausible option, and increasingly are resorting to other mechanisms of resource distribution, particularly social protection. Within part of that, I mean, the other sort of dimension of distribution is obviously with respect to ethnicity. I'll talk about more about that later on, but essentially there's fundamental tension that exists between the developmental state agenda, which is inherently a sort of centralizing project, with any kind of real distribution of powers within a federal system. The challenges that are facing the country now, two of the principal challenges I would say that are facing the country now in terms of distribution, are reconciling with two quite long-standing challenges that within Ethiopia, that in a new manifestation of them, but goes back to some of the debates right back to the 1960s and 70s, in terms of one, livelihoods. How do you guarantee a large section of the Ethiopian population access to a secure livelihood, and secondly, the role of ethnicity within politics. So, in terms of the theory, I won't spend too long on this. But the starting point is actually the literature on, the most sort of advanced literature, I would say, in terms of theoretically, is the literature on the welfare state, and trying to understand in terms of how distribution is managed. But that literature, I mean, it takes obviously a very particular starting point in that it assumes the existence of a labour market, and the primary challenge in terms of distribution is in terms of the contingencies and risks that exist with respect to an established labour market, so unemployment, old age, and so on. And that then leads to certain forms of social protection, whether it's social insurance and models or social assistance. You move to an agrarian society, you face a very different set of challenges, and I would argue the main risks that are faced within an agrarian society would be how to guarantee access to agricultural production in terms of key inputs that you require, so land, labour, and other agricultural inputs that are required for reliable production. And within that context, Jeremy Seekin's work has been useful in terms of identifying what he calls an agrarian welfare regime, where he argues many African states have historically, both in terms of concrete actions, but also in terms of narratives, sought to provide welfare primarily through access to land and other agricultural inputs rather than sort of your formal social protection programs. Now, the challenge is that in most developing countries are at this sort of intermediate point where they are making a rather uncertain transition between the two. So, it's, you know, in terms of the agrarian side, you know, the agrarian welfare regime is no longer, if it ever was, able to provide secure livelihoods to a majority of the population. In terms of land shortages, shortage of agricultural inputs and so on, and unreliability of production. And at the same time, on the other side, industrialization, high productivity services haven't necessarily taken off and provided the mass employment that many would hope for. And so there's this sort of balancing act of processes of both commodification, and disembedding, creating a labour market and employment opportunities, but then equally in sort of Polanyian terms, these attempts to expand social protection and decommodify these processes. So essentially what I'm trying to do is sort of set the scope of my analysis in terms of access to land, agricultural inputs, employment and social protection as the kind of key mechanisms of distribution and how these are managed within a process of transformation. In terms of the politics of this, what I'm going to talk about now draws again quite a lot from the sort of welfare state literature in terms of viewing distribution as ultimately a political struggle between different interest groups within society, within the institutional constraints of existing state structures. But at the same time, it also builds on a broader body of work which looks at the role of ideas within politics. So basically the argument that interest groups, you can't just necessarily just read off the material interests of particular classes based on their position within the system of production, but ideas fundamentally shape the interests and the actions of a different state and societal actors. Taking that as a starting point, it then is necessary, as you know, there's a lot of literature on the politics of development in recent years, which highlights that you need to fundamentally reinterpret those ideas, because politics in developing countries very often works in quite fundamentally different ways. First of all, you can't take political competition for granted. Very often, political mobilisation is severely constrained, and so while you know it is certainly possible for groups to mobilise politically, very often you have state actors and political elites act in sort of anticipation of the threat or their assessment of the distribution of power within society rather than necessarily in response to active mobilisation. The class which is reified within this welfare state literature in terms of class mobilisation being the key driver of redistribution. Class may or may not be the most salient form of political mobilisation in developing countries, and it's necessary to sort of examine how class interacts with other factors such as ethnicity, region and religion and so on. And finally, that informal institutions fundamentally shape the way that politics actually works, so you need to go beyond the formal institutions of the state in understanding these processes. Now, I'm setting myself up for a problem here, in that you know this is the sort of core of the theoretical framework that I'm looking at. But obviously, this then bleeds into a whole range of issues related to agrarian political economy, sort of state-led developments, global political economy, and even demography. So I'm going to set those theories aside slightly, rather than tackle them all and then spend an hour talking to you about theory. But yes, I am wrestling with those issues and happy to sort of discuss more if people have questions. But I want to move on, first of all, to the sort of more empirical material. So yeah, starting with the early years of the TPLF and what that ultimately became the EPRDF. So for those of you who are not Ethiopian specialists, the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, began as a sort of anti-government insurgency in the mid-1970s, gradually fought a civil war and ultimately came to national power in 1991 and in the process formed this multi-ethnic coalition, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which then came to national power. Now, the argument I've got is essentially that, you know, two underlying principles have sort of underpinned their strategy for mobilization, both in from the insurgency and moving forward. First of all, they pursued in the insurrection was a Maoist political strategy of mobilizing the peasantry, where right from the beginning they basically recognized that tangible, broad-based socio-economic progress was one of the key means of mobilizing people, basically making it clear to people that they would benefit from TPLF rule. So the main ways they did that initially was in terms of land reform and then service delivery in liberated areas. But at the same time, they also had a very distinct ethno-nationalist message. They mobilized the Tigrayan people based on sort of rationale narratives that the Tigrayans had been oppressed within Ethiopia and that this was a sort of a liberation struggle as well. And these sort of principles have been taken forward when the TPLF came to national power. First of all, they redrew the structure of Ethiopian politics in terms of creating what's been come to be known as ethnic federalism. So that's a map of Ethiopia pre-1991. That's what they redrew from the new constitution in terms of from 1994 onwards. Essentially, what they did was try to draw around ethno-linguistic groups, so to provide self-administration for the different ethno-linguistic groups within Ethiopia. And to provide then with self-determination and decentralized administration. Now, the reality of it is quite different in that, you know, decentralized structures were implemented across the country, but in terms of the actual meaningful devolution of power, it was still significantly constrained in terms of both the sort of strength of the federal government over the regional states, but also the party structure, which, you know, had maintained central powers over a lot of different policy areas. Now, as many people have written in the literature, this was partly about maintaining the dominance of the EPRDF, undoubtedly, and no doubt the TPLF within that, but it's also necessitated by the development strategy that they employed as the other half of this sort of legitimizing rationale. So yeah, quite early on in 1994, they laid out this, or even 1993, I think the first version was, they laid out this economic development strategy. This character here is Noai Gebreab, who was here last year as part of, was it part of the Horn of Africa series or Northeast Africa series, or was it a separate event?
It was a separate event. Martin School.
But yeah, he was here last year. He was one of the architects of this strategy, along with the Prime Minister Mullahs. And that strategy, right from the beginning, it was fundamentally concerned with distributional challenges as well as economic growth, I would argue. And particularly the challenge of population growth. So it marks that out as the single overriding challenge facing the country. Or as he expressed it, the challenge they were facing was a race between population growth and growth in agriculture, which had to be won in favor of agricultural growth. The concern being that population growth is going to result in extreme rural land shortages. It's going to exacerbate the already existing problem of food insecurity, which had been an issue since the 84 famine and long before. And that in the absence of the capacity of the agricultural sector to absorb large numbers of people, it was then going to result in the persistent onslaught of rural to urban migration and thereby political instability. So essentially there was this race against time in their view, to raise agricultural productivity and ultimately to industrialize and create industrial employment, which would then be able to absorb this labor. So this is my sort of stylized version, slightly stylized. I mean, it's quite close to the literal strategy in many ways, of what they were trying to do in terms of agricultural development-led industrialization. So essentially their starting point was state land ownership, which had been created by the previous Marxist regime. The TPLF itself had redistributed land in liberated areas. But state land ownership became a mechanism of ensuring that smallholder farmers retained access to land, and land was relatively equally distributed within the country. The idea was that if you provide technology to these farmers that doesn't replace labour but raises productivity, things like fertilisers, improved seeds, irrigation, you'll be able, first of all, to raise agricultural productivity, providing wage foods, industrial inputs, primary exports, which will then be able to earn you foreign exchange internationally, and ultimately help you to support a conscious effort on promoting labour-intensive urban industry. And then the idea is that you'll then start to be able to promote linkages back and forth between them, that smallholder agriculture, as farmers become more wealthy, will become a domestic market for locally produced industrial goods. You can then start to produce value-added exports, and as industry really takes off, ultimately you'll be able to transfer surplus labour from the agricultural sector into the industrial sector. Now, this is a sort of a strategy for essentially resolving all of Ethiopia's problems. The assumption is that essentially all, quite explicitly, all farmers will be able to benefit from these technologies. Essentially, they'll be scale neutral, and so it will solve both the problem of food insecurity, but also raising productivity. It will drive industrialization, but it was also fundamentally a political strategy, and quite explicitly so. That the idea was you keep people in rural areas where they can't be a political problem initially, and you only allow sort of rural to urban migration as employment's created in the industrial sector, and sort of gradually allow that transition to take place, with state land ownership being one of the key mechanisms by which this is done. And in many ways, this sort of typifies this agrarian welfare regime that I mentioned before, and that, you know, it's a mechanism of providing welfare and support to small farmers through access to land and access to agricultural inputs. Now, it was always a bit aspirational, I think it's fair to say, in that the idea of a land as a safety net, probably in 1993, like the last land redistributions in most of the country were in the late 1980s, you know, landlessness at that point in time was fairly low, but already by 2001, when they relaunched this strategy, you know, there would have been sizable numbers of people 10 years or more after the last land redistribution who would have lacked access to land. And in terms of the implementation, you can point to various different failings of what actually happened on the ground. Nonetheless, this was a sort of an important attempt in terms of a distributional strategy. It was relatively egalitarian. There's Prime Minister Meles, who was well aware of the challenges that they were facing and the limitations. So in his view, what constituted the nightmare scenario would be that you don't have agricultural productivity increases, you're not able to create off-farm employment. Essentially, you have extreme food insecurity, rural landlessness, and as a result, large numbers of people coming to the cities where they're going to then cause all kinds of trouble. And a threat to political stability. Now, essentially, what you had in the early 2000s was, and continuing since then, are manifestations of that central challenge, I would say. You had what the political leadership at the time, so the Deputy Prime Minister, Meles, and others, termed a series of Armageddons, so these existential political crises, which ultimately sort of in a rather, it wasn't a sort of a one-off reform, but a gradual process of evolution of strategy led to changes in the development agenda. The key factors being, first of all, in terms of the urban protests in 2001, starting in the university and spreading across the city, but then also in 2005 with the heavily contested elections then, essentially the recognition within the leadership that this strategy focused on agriculture to a significant degree to the neglect of urban areas was no longer supportable, that they were brought severe risks, not assuming that you're focusing on agriculture and assuming that ultimately this was going to lead to an urban transformation as well, and that you needed to do something about urban areas much more urgently rather than just waiting for agriculture to deliver. Number one, the food crisis in 2003 kind of really questioned many of the rationales underpinning ADLI. In that year, some 14 million people required emergency assistance as a result of a major drought, but sort of it questioned this narrative of agricultural productivity increases, solving the food insecurity problem, raising productivity and creating a surplus in general. And ultimately, the TPLF split, which basically led to Meles emerging as a sort of uncontested leader within the TPLF and ultimately the EPRDF, and centralizing power around him essentially enabled this switch in strategy that followed on. Now, as part of that, there are also a sort of a range of different people, academics and advisors that they engaged with. They particularly talked about Alice Amsden. Apparently Muller's read Alice Amsden's book sometime in the late 1980s and then told all his economic advisors that they had to read this wonderful book. And then a range of other people who were brought in to advise them at different points in time. And it's hard to chart exactly what influence that had, but clearly was part of the story. And then the final part, I think, which is also important, was that following 2001, they carried out this process of decentralization, which massively increased the capacity at local government levels and actually gave them a realistic chance of being able to implement some of this agenda at local levels. So what this has ultimately turned into is this developmental state agenda. I mean, roughly speaking, I think you can chart it to around about 2005, but it's definitely a sort of an evolution and sort of over a period of 10 to 15 years. The pictures along the right-hand side are what sort of is normally associated with this agenda. So you've got Adama Industrial Park, which was one of the most recent ones, horticultural farms, large-scale investors, and sugar plantations. It's notable that in terms of analyses of actually of Ethiopia's growth experience, don't actually figure very much. They're very notable in terms of the analyses and the case studies and the shining examples. The main source of economic growth, and Ethiopia has been growing very rapidly in recent years, have been massive debt finance public infrastructure in terms of railways, roads, dams and so on, and then an urban construction boom. Yet alongside that, there are some other important economic priorities as well. Within the smallholder sector, there was essentially a recognition that this idea you could provide technology to every single smallholder in Ethiopia and raise their productivity has been sort of accepted that was never going to happen. And there's been an attempt to focus on the high potential farmers. So concentrating supplies of agricultural inputs to what they've been termed model farmers, who tend to be among the most wealthy, but then are also it's a strategy for political mobilization as well. Increased focus on commercialization. There have been land reforms which have gradually started to introduce market incentives into land tenure by removing restrictions on rental and most recently allowing mortgaging in certain parts of the country and soon to be, it would seem, across the country. And very recently there's a push that now they're building these big agro-industrial parks which will link, the theory is at least, 400,000 smallholder farmers to a central agro-processing plant which will then sort of add value to the crops that these smallholders are producing. So all initiatives focus around commercialization of the highest potential farmers. Alongside these capital-intensive agricultural investments, so broadly speaking, you can sort of make a distinction between the horticultural farms, many of which have been quite successful, around Addis, Rift Valley, and other sort of other key sort of transport centres, and the large-scale plantations. That the guy with the tractor is Ram Karaturi, the sort of large-scale Indian investor, who, amongst other large-scale investors, has been a complete disaster and a massive failure. And then finally, you have the industrial policy. So, I mean, there was a push right from the beginning to explicitly target labour-intensive industrial sectors, particularly textiles and apparel, based on the assumption that these would create more employment, absorb more labour. And I think, I mean, research has shown, I mean, they are quite impressive. There has clearly been a lot of thinking going on from the government side. They have been clearly quite proactive. Yet in terms of the overall economic contribution, it's still pretty minuscule of these industrial parks to date. There's by all accounts, it seems that many major global firms are set to relocate significant chunks of their production to Ethiopia, so there's a potential for it to grow quite rapidly. But for the time being, it remains quite limited. So in terms of the sort of continuities and changes, I mean, there's a clear continuity in aspects of this. The Ethiopian government still says that it's pursuing ADLI, and there are continuities in the sense that there's a common focus on industrialization, structural transformation of the economy, There's a focus on, as there was previously, on linking agriculture and industry, so you sort of you add value within Ethiopia rather than exporting primary commodities. Yet there are also important changes. So they've kind of ditched the agriculture first approach, and now it's sort of a dual agriculture and industry at the same time, but trying to promote linkages between them. But fundamentally, they focused on high potential rather than this sort of broad-based strategy. And it's in that sense that I think the sort of the key fundamental difference is in terms of this distributional strategy. That first of all, there's now an explicit intention to differentiate between smallholders, so not the assumption that everyone will be able to benefit, but an acceptance grudgingly in many quarters that the least able are going to have to move out of agriculture, and land reforms that allow rental, first in Amhara, now be under consideration by the federal government, and the provision to allow mortgaging of land are clearly targeted towards providing the highest potential farmers with the opportunities to expand production and intensify production, with the result that many of those less able are going to have to move out of agriculture. That's completely different from the rationale of Adley and something that wouldn't have been considered for a long time. Indeed, for many years, the assumption was that mortgaging was against the constitution. It's only latterly that people have sort of looked at the wording carefully and wondered whether perhaps it isn't, after all. So there's an assumption people will now start to move out of agriculture, but the challenge is that the question is where do they actually go from that? You have a situation of mass landlessness. So there's been, as I said before, there's been no redistribution in most places since the late 1980s. Massive population growth in that period. They're about to do another census in a couple of months, but according to the last census in 2007, somewhere in the region of 80% of the population would have been less than 18 in the late 1980s and therefore would not have access to land through redistribution. Now, some of those people would have inherited land, some of them would be able to sort of use a bit of land from their parents on a more informal basis, but there's a huge chunk of the rural population that don't have access to land. And so this rationale of land as a safety net that the government had pushed for years is no longer supportable in any meaningful way. There's a lack of data, but there's a couple of studies recently sort of suggested that somewhere in the region of 30 to 40% of the rural population lacks land. On the other hand, you've got this sort of emerging success story in manufacturing, some major firms relocating to Ethiopia. This was kind of has been the holy grail for the Ethiopian government for several decades. Yet at the same time, it's not creating the employment as yet, and possibly seems unlikely to ever do so, that is required to absorb this enormous amount of surplus labour. So currently, the industrial parks provide somewhere in the region of 20,000 or 30,000 jobs. There are some optimistic targets that by 2025 they might create some 2 million jobs. Which, if it happens, will be a great achievement, undeniably, but at the same time, it still pales in comparison to a population of 110 million people, where somewhere in the region of a million new young adults enter the job market every single year. Studies suggest that the limited studies that exist suggest very high rates of urban unemployment and rural landlessness. And at the same time, then these industrial parks themselves are then built on labour suppression. So there's been increasing concerns about the working conditions within the industrial parks themselves, and essentially they're based on, internationally they're competitive because of the extraordinarily low wage costs, not because of any higher productivity within Ethiopia. It's basically a low wage mechanism of trying to secure parts of the global value chain. And alongside this, you've got this developmental state displacing people for a range of different rationales. So, I mean, this state land ownership has gone through various different phases in terms of the objectives, the rationales by which it's justified. Increasingly, it's been justified in terms of the centralization of rents and the ability for the state to allocate factors of production to priority sectors. So what this means is essentially that people are displaced for agricultural investments, for industrial parks, for infrastructure development, and also a key issue being urban expansion, which cities across Ethiopia are expanding extremely rapidly. To provide an example of what this actually means in practice, this is from a study we did recently in Adama. So Adama's gone through waves of different expansion, both the expansion of the city, but also then in terms of infrastructure. So back in 2008, near to the city, there was the expansion of the Wenjishoa sugar factory, which displaced a certain number of small farmers. At that time, they were paid 8 birr per square meter. So currently, the exchange rate is somewhere in the region of 35 birr to the pound. But yeah, it would have been a bit less at that time. 2010, 12 birr per square meter for the expressway linking Adama and Addis. 15 birr for the railway that goes from Addis through Adama onto Djibouti. 53 birr for the most recently for the industrial park that was built there. At the same time, in terms of illegal land sales, by all accounts, you can buy you can sell land for up to 1,000 birr per square meter on illegal land markets. Now, unsurprisingly, this is quite a strong incentive for people to sell land. So essentially what you've got, it seems increasingly clear that around most urban centres, around most of infrastructure development, where there's clear sign that at some point the state is going to come in and dispossess you through with very minimal compensation, there is what was described by one respondent as an economy of anticipation, essentially this rush to sell land as quickly as possible before the state arrives. And essentially, still formally it's state ownership, privatisation of land is well underway in many places. Now, the government's aware of this. In the current context, local governments are unable to intervene and sort of stop these practices. There's discussions within federal governments. They're talking about a new draft compensation proclamation. Whether it will come to pass or not, I don't know. It's been stuck for a little while now, by all accounts. But yeah, the provisions within that, the revised provisions within that are only that it will increase compensation rates by somewhere in the region of 50%, which obviously is going to come, not even going to come close to closing that gap between current compensation and what you can actually get by selling land. So into this midst of mass landlessness and very high rates of unemployment, essentially what you're seeing is the emergence of a new forms of redistribution. And this has been going on over an extended period of time, both in response to these earlier Armageddons, but also in response to the sort of disembedding processes of the developmental state. So the principal program within this is the productive safety net, which was the sort of direct response to the food crisis back in 2002-03. Which is one of the largest social protection programs in Africa, covering up to 10 million people in terms of cash and food transfers. This was initially intended by government to be, as they termed it, a mechanism of keeping things calm while we're implementing this other economic agenda. It wasn't really seen as a solution in itself. The solution was rapid economic development, industrialization and employment. But yes, the PSNP was seen as this sort of intermediate sticking plaster which would keep things calm while it was being implemented. But yet, 14 years later, enrollment increases rather than decreases. It's still somewhere in the region of 8 to 10 million people enrolled in it. In informal discussions, many government officials will admit that, that is a massive underestimate, and really you should have somewhere in the region of 5 or more million people who meet the criteria of being chronically food insecure, which is the rationale for inclusion in the program, and so should be on it, but it's considered politically unacceptable to actually increase the numbers at this point. And you also have responses and social protection responses in response to the urban crises of 2001-2005, most directly the sort of youth development package which promoted MSEs from 2006, food subsidies from 2008, and most recently then this urban safety net, this urban counterpart, where some 500,000 people will soon be receiving support. Now, I call this a pauperist productivist regime that seems to be emerging. Essentially, this is the pauperist part is in a sort of a reference to the sort of tradition of providing narrowly targeted poor relief, going back to the English poor laws. The productivist part is this sort of long-standing rationale within the PRDF that any support that you provide to people has to come back with contributions. So people have to, they can't just be given money or resources without contributing themselves. They have to also work and be seen to be working for the support that they receive. So there's this rationale that these programs are going to make a productive impact as well, which is arguable whether that's actually materialized in practice. So in terms of, I haven't mentioned ethnicity for some time, which is probably relevant in that, you know, the developmental state agenda has essentially, I mean, I would argue there's this fundamental trade-off between the interventionist developmentalism, which is fundamentally a sort of centralizing development model, and real federalism. So whether that's in terms of, you know, federal government allocating land for agriculture investments, could their control over the creation of industrial parks, infrastructure, and so on, it requires federal intervention into regional states. And essentially, I mean, in addition to a whole range of political motivations in terms of centralizing power, just in terms of the economic strategy itself, there's a fundamental tension there between the federal and regional governments. Now, the challenge that's sort of increasingly come up is that, you know, very often, you know, the narrative is that Ethiopia, you know, Ethiopia is making this big sacrifice for national development. For, you know, there's a process of delayed gratification rather than necessarily seeing the benefits now. You're seeing, you know, these are necessary steps to sort of create development over the coming years. Now, the problem is that within a ruling party that's continues to have been, perceived as dominated by the TPLF, by one minority ethnic group, this then, rather than national sacrifice, comes across as ethnic exploitation. And over the years, you've seen an increasingly assertive set of ethno-regional administrations, the regional states, contesting federal control. Now, I would have said this was happening to some degree before Meles passed away in 2012. You saw, yeah, particularly governments in Oromia and Amhara increasingly protective of their own autonomy, but very much since then, the removal of the kingpin, the removal of the central power, and the fragmentation at the centre has led to this sort of devolution of powers in practice, and regional governments becoming increasingly assertive. And the result is that gradually distributional concerns have become increasingly influenced by ethnic politics as much as anything else. So to take a couple of recent examples, you know, this strategy of building industrial parks is influenced very much by this criteria of fairness between the different regions rather than necessarily a strong business case. So the most obvious example being the decision to build an industrial park in Asosa, in the far west of the country, which has no rationale in terms of trade linkages, in terms of labour availability or anything else, but is basically a political decision based on the balancing act across Ethiopia's regions. And equally, within the industrial parks themselves, there are quite clear ethnic quotas of where of the labour employment opportunities within the industrial parks. I feel I should mention or have a discussion about the Oromo protests themselves quite explicitly. And essentially, I'm sure many of you are already familiar, so I won't say anything terribly new. Widespread anti-government protests beginning 2014, but really accelerating in 2016 and 17 and culminating in 2018. They were very brutally put down by the military initially. That failed for any significant period to stop them, and ultimately culminated in the resignation of the Prime Minister, Haile Mariam, about a year ago, almost exactly. There were a range of different flashpoints within this, but central concerns were the flashpoints were around land, territory, displacement, growing ethno-nationalism and this perception of the oppression of the Oromo, dominance of the Tigrayans within government. But these were protests conducted mainly by young men in rural areas, small towns, exactly the kind of people who have, this emerging development strategy offers no real answers to. people who see no real options within the agricultural sector, their chances of inheriting land and having a viable agricultural livelihood are pretty much gone. Many of them are quite well educated now, and so agricultural livelihoods aren't particularly desirable anyway. But equally, urban employment opportunities are quite limited. There's a handful of industrial jobs in industrial parks, but then, poor working conditions or perception of poor working conditions within them. And the other alternative being day labour in urban centres, which is unreliable and poorly paid. And so it's particularly this group who've seen little option from the current distributional system, which were among the main protagonists in the protests. I haven't mentioned Abiy hardly at all yet. So he took power in April last year and has unleashed all kinds of manner of political reforms, upended the political landscape in Ethiopia. I'm not going to comment too much on that, other than the implication of this analysis is essentially that there are two fundamental distributional strategies which he, or indeed his successor, were he to lose power in elections which are supposed to be held next year, will have to face. In that one, how do you create employment opportunities, livelihoods for a rapidly growing number of Ethiopians who also have also increasing expectations given the educational attainment that they're increasingly getting. But then equally, what role does ethnicity play in politics in Ethiopia, or what role should it play? And particularly this challenge of how do you reconcile the sort of the centralized state that's underpinned this period of rapid economic growth with the desire and increasingly the reality of real federalism and real devolution of power from the federal government. Now, in many ways, it's far from a perfect match, but these are sort of new manifestations of two central challenges that go back to the 1960s, as I said before, in terms of the land to the tiller campaigns, in terms of land redistribution, and also the national question as it was framed. So it's something of an irony then that despite the fact that the EPRDF, which came out of that movement, identified these two factors as the central concerns for its time in power, has been unable to definitively resolve either. And while I'm particularly recently, the sort of ethnicity element has attracted a lot of attention in terms of there have been widespread conflicts which have often ended up polarizing along ethnic lines over the last year, I suspect it may well be the former, which is at least as hard, if not harder, to actually resolve ultimately. As a follow-up to that, and the debate at points within this has been sort of a question of whether this state-led development model that the EPRDF has been pursuing should be retained as though it's a choice. Certainly that was the sort of more or less the framing of Alex Duval's piece that he wrote last year, which was quite good in many ways, which basically said, these are the challenges of ditching the developmental state and pursuing a political marketplace, as his theory puts it. Yet, to my mind, the politics that underpin this state-led development model have evaporated quite some time ago. Essentially, I think there is this fundamental tension between state-led development and the form that's been pursued in Ethiopia and real federalism. Currently, the ruling coalition is fragmented into all kinds of different factions, which the idea of getting any kind of coherent vision out of them it seems highly unlikely. It's unclear even what Abiy or anyone else wants in terms of the development model. At points they've sort of said we're going to continue with the developmental state and state-led development. Other points it's liberalisation. It's unclear. But ultimately I think Ethiopia is probably just too diverse and politically mobilised at this point to submit itself back to this sort of highly centralised, somewhat coercive developmental state agenda. And there's increasing this push for distribution now rather than delayed gratification for the future. And the final point, it's clear from case studies that we've been doing across the country in the last year or so, Muller's, one of his claims of one of the EPRDF's crowning achievements was in terms of building state capacity. And in his terms, he said that our writ runs in every village or some words to that effect. Essentially, whatever they decided at the top would get implemented at the bottom. They had that capacity across the country. Now, is this probably still exists in Tigray to a significant degree? There is this sort of the central control, and those structures are there at local level. Case studies we've done in Amhara and Oromia in the last year, they're just not. Like, the Kabele administrations are, you know, local population very often are just telling them to get lost, essentially. The sort of instructions that come down from the top, you know, mobilization, the campaigns, that are being required. If those local administrators are brave enough to try and rally the rally the local population, local people are ignoring them. And the sort of the structures through which they're mobilised, these development teams, these 1-5 groups, which groupings of households and subsections within a village, have evaporated. So they still exist in Tigray, but in the rest of the country, they don't seem to be a major feature whatsoever anymore. And I decided to stick this last slide in, which is a bit more speculative, but I would be keen to get people's thoughts. To my mind, there's been a lot of analysis of and talk about African industrialization in the last few years, and some very good analysis, of which Ethiopia is kind of at the forefront, in that it clearly has had a very clear industrial policy and has had certain successes that flowed from it. So the question comes back, so if this is the success story, and in many ways it is the success story, what does ultimately the success of African industrialization look like? Now, I don't pretend to have an answer to this, but it does raise a whole series of questions around, you know, going back to the agrarian question of labor, Henry Bernstein and others, in terms of the role, the role of agricultural labor within a capitalist economy, particularly given growing population pressure, landlessness, decreasing farm size, a very clear trend in terms of industrialization from the early industrializers through to the present of increasing capital intensity and reducing labor intensity of industrial production. And what Tanya Murray-Lee has kind of termed this challenge of surplus labor, labor that isn't required by capital, and what to do with it. So it raises the possibility, at least, that, you know, one sort of interpretation of where Ethiopia is heading is that maybe it will continue with its success in terms of industrialization and manufacturing, but essentially you might end up with a sort of high productivity manufacturing sector in a sea of relatively low productivity services and agriculture. Now, the government is clearly thinking in those terms and has been trying to establish links to the rest of the economy, but the success so far seems to have been quite modest, and yeah, we'll see where it goes in the future. I will leave it there, and I welcome your comments. Thank you.